Jalen and Jacoby, the After Show is presented by ADT, Real Protection.
And now, Jalen and Jacoby.
Welcome to Jalen and Jacoby, the After Show. Here we are, live on another Sunday night. However, instead of celebrating the life of Michael Jordan, we have a very different tone and flavor to this evening's documentary film. This time it's about Lance Armstrong, where Michael Jordan celebrated. He's the GOAT, the greatest of all time, the champion. He's a hero. We all love him. We all want to be like Mike. Lance Armstrong's story is much more complicated, and it couldn't be more of a contrast to the way these documentaries started, because this documentary started with a story of Lance Armstrong in the current day of basically someone at a bar standing up and saying F you to him, and then the entire table stands up and says F you to him, and then he calls the bar and pays their tab and tells them that he loves them. So, Jalen, sort of like, as we get started, what do you think about the contrast between the celebration of Michael Jordan and the sort of investigation slash analyzation of Lance Armstrong we saw?
Well, it's been a lot of contrast in my life, Jacoby. I'm used to being on planes almost every other day, going in and out of the city and doing all of that type of stuff. Now it's a pandemic and I'm not moving around. The other thing is I'm used to falling asleep during movies. Now I need to watch them. You know, mm-hmm. So I'm staying up late. Right now it's the After Show. I'm on social media. Lance is trending. Cheater is trending. Doping is trending. And you're right. It isn't the celebration of greatness for somebody that accomplished so very much that we were able to enjoy with The Last Dance and Michael Jordan. But it is a cautionary tale of when you're so very willing to teeter the line in order to be great and take certain chances and even cheat if it means that it's going to put you in position to not only make money but be successful.
Absolutely. And I think one thing I found really interesting about this film was the filmmaker right off the beginning sort of set the tone, because we've already heard some criticisms about The Last Dance, about this being a Michael Jordan puff piece and him controlling the narrative and it not necessarily being a true objective sort of view.
How long you been to open? How long you been to open? How long you been to open? I was like, okay.
Yeah, but obviously from the very beginning, they set the tone. As you could tell, they cut together a montage, as Jalen was referring to, of basically the filmmaker asking, when was the first time you doped? And it seemed like from the reaction of the subjects that it was the very first question that she asked in the film. And I think that was a message to the audience that this is not a Lance Armstrong puff piece. This is not a Lance Armstrong controlled narrative. This is not a Lance Armstrong is back, let's celebrate him. That it is going to be an objective, honest look at him and his current state and sort of his story, but also his current state right now. And they kind of started with the right now, with him settling the case with the U.S. Postal Service, which is a $100 million case against the government, which he paid a $5 million settlement for early on in the film. Jalen, watching those scenes of him in the car explaining why he paid the $5 million, what did you feel?
Well, he was trying to talk about all of the theories and doing all of the math and trying to make us believe like it was mathematically better for him to take the route that he chose. What I'll say is I remember the Livestrong bracelets. I remember him like being one of the more celebrated athletes, and watching his story from a youngster and seeing his family dynamic and his father really wasn't in his life and then took credit for everything that happened in his life, was really mean to him and mean to his mom and that type of thing. And when he was 15, his mother was forging birth certificates and put him in position to participate and all of that type of stuff. He came from a broken home. But one of the things I learned, Jacoby, as people start to have your own reasoning skills and your own karma as you start to get older, your pain from your childhood doesn't excuse your decisions. Mm. And he wasn't able to divorce what happened to him and the turbulence that he was able to endure in order for him not to be one of those people that live basically indirectly by this term and they don't know this. Hurt people hurt people.
Yes. And I think that's a good way to transition into something that really sort of opened my eyes about Lance Armstrong, because I haven't studied Lance Armstrong. I didn't read books about him. I follow his career the same way a general sports fan would. And sort of when he was on top, when he toured to France after Tour de France, I celebrated him and loved him like everyone else, and also everything he did for testicular cancer. But we get to know a little bit about his personality, and he was not a soft, warm, friendly person, to say the very, very least. I mean, he was early on in the film. They said that there were sort of like these hints that he was kind of a bully and not a great supportive teammate early on in his life when he was 14, 15, racing and 16, racing against adults, but still kind of talking trash and kind of being a jerk and not being a humble, like sort of rookie beginner in the triathlon circuit. And that was something that really opened my eyes, because you see the same thing with The Last Dance. And I hate to keep bringing it back to that, but that's sort of the experience that we're all having in the quarantine and these Sunday nights watching these documentaries, is Jordan was also kind of a jerk. Lance Armstrong, also kind of a jerk. So my question for you is, someone who's not exactly greatness himself, but been around a lot of greatness in his career,
Do you think
there's causation? Like, do you kind of have to be obsessive and maybe a little bit narcissistic and maybe a little competitive and mean to achieve this kind of championship greatness?
Well, just so you know, I was great on every level except the NBA. And that's what happens in competition. Don't think I wasn't dominant in elementary or middle school or AAU or high school or college. It happened. And what he's alluding to, and what happens to an athlete, and we see this with Lance, is that, yeah, there were times when it was a different season and he played a different sport and they showed him running as a 15-year-old and basically keeping up with the older racers and drawing the attention of the media and that type of stuff, and doing all type of athletic things. He's swimming in this doc. He's showing that he loves the sport and that he's an athlete in his heart. But what goes very, like kind of hit me between my eyeballs, and I can't get over this, is that he was cheating really young, Jacoby, and early. So what happens is, when you're living a lie, of course you're on edge. Of course you're more of a jerk, because you know that there's some skeletons in the closet and you don't know when they're going to blow up in your face. And so his behavior, I think, was a lot of an arrogance, but also a byproduct of that.
Absolutely. And I think that they sort of explore his personality. And I want to touch on something that you brought up earlier, which was sort of explored early in the doc, which contributed to his personality, is his family life and his upbringing. His mother, I believe, had him when she was 17 or 18 years old. So they essentially, as he put it, grew up together. And there was a character in this documentary who I will call the Jerry Krause of this documentary. There is a character, through his very, very short screen time, just made him so unlikable, which is a gentleman by the name of Terry Armstrong, which is someone who was around Lance's life when he was a boy, not his actual father, but, you know, carries his last name.
And I'm Terry the reason Armstrong, why. It's because of me.
Exactly. Terry Armstrong was in his life for a number of years when he was a child, and there was some exploration of some perhaps physical abuse that Terry Armstrong put on Lance. And Terry Armstrong and Lance have different views of this, and I believe Lance is. But Terry Armstrong said that it was him being tough on Lance and him being a disciplinarian and the way that he pushed Lance as a boy that gave him that sort of championship pedigree as an adult, which is ridiculous, because, you know, we all know that you know, failure is an orphan and success has many fathers, and nothing is more clear indicator of that than this. But one thing I want to ask you about is not about Terry Armstrong, but also about his biological father in that relationship, which was basically nothing. And Jalen, for some of the people watching and listening to this might not know, is you also didn't know your biological father. What effect do you think that had on your character, your personality, and your career?
Here's what not having a father did for me. And I'm not going to act like it made me better, but as somebody that grew up in a family full of faith and embrace what was in front of me. So I had a great mom, grandmother, grandfather, uncles, brothers, the neighborhood. I'm the youngest of four. Like, I felt like I had a great support group. And my neighbors and friends also, in a lot of cases, didn't have fathers in the home. So sadly, I thought that was normal. So I didn't feel some type of way about not having a father, or some type of insecurity, or that I was even missing something. I didn't know that nurturing that could be in my life. And so one of the things that it seems like Lance's mother did that I'm very grateful that my mother did not do is bring different men around. She ain't do that. She did not do that. If she was dating or doing whatever she was doing as an adult, unless they was boyfriends, I met a couple of those, they ain't come to the crib.
And, that's interesting.
And so I didn't get the influence of men outside of really being my father and allowing them to either aid or pollute my goals.
That's really interesting because there's a one line I think is very telling about Lance, which is actually about Terry Armstrong leaving his life. I believe it was when he was around 14 or 15. He says, well, it was just back to me and my mom like normal. So that wasn't that bad for me. And it kind of, you get the idea that him and his mom were the constant in his life and the other people that were in the home or in their life were sort of secondary or tertiary and were sort of expendable in his mind. And he was just focused on that one.
Tertiary? You've been using some big words and some great phrases since we went to ESPN.
I don't know how to spell that. I'm not sure if I used it correctly. I was really going out on a limb there. I was hoping that you wouldn't call me out, but of course you did. And now I'm a little nervous that I used it right. Please, my mom's an English teacher, so I hope that she's not upset with me.
You know a million people are going to watch this, right?
I hope so. I hope so. And I think that it was around this time when he's 15 or 16 when he starts competing against adults. And you can tell and what they found interesting is he wasn't always a cycler. It was a triathlon thing. If you don't know, triathlon is swimming and then running and then biking. And he was a true triathlete, and the endurance sports really spoke to him because in his own words, he was uncoordinated. So you remember growing up in Texas is a football place. You know what I mean? It's a stick and ball place. And sort of he chose cycling because sort of children choose what they're good at. And he was always good at riding a bike and not so good at some of the stick and ball sports. And that led the documentary to do a little short sort of history and origin story of the sport of cycling. And it's something that I never really thought about, but cycling has no foothold in the U.S. And Lance was unique for that reason, that it was such a European dominated sport. Like growing up, were there any speed cyclers that you knew? Was there any opportunity to go to like a velodrome? Like growing up in Massachusetts where I was, there was no such thing outside of BMX biking where cycling was competitive, like racing. Is that consistent with you?
Absolutely. The only BM I knew about had an F at the end, not an X. So I agree with you. And one of the things about as I started to grow and started to ride bikes a lot more, I tried to pop a lot of wheelies and stuff like that. I wasn't good at it. I wasn't comfortable doing it. Other people were so very more talented and could hit blocks doing wheelies and stuff like that. Bikes uncomfortable, you know, hurt my butt, you know, made it sore, you know, so I wasn't enthusiastic. But for Lance, you know, it seemed like he grew up in an era similar to mine, Jacoby, as I saw multiple pictures of sports that he played, because that's how it used to be. It was like, oh, okay, during football season, you might have got me, but what's going to happen during baseball season? Oh, let's play some soccer. Let's play some basketball. So he got a chance to play multiple sports. And for him, like you said, being – as he called it, uncoordinated and falling in love with cycling, he all of a sudden made it mainstream because he was successful as an American in a sport that normally we don't dominate. So he became must-see TV in a lot of ways.
Jalen, there's so much more to discuss with part one of Lance, but before we get to that, I just want to mention that when it matters most, trust ADT. Now more than ever, you need peace of mind with 24/7 rapid response monitoring from the leader in home security. Be an everyday hero by staying safe at home while ADT helps protect you and your loved ones. ADT has 9 owned and operated U.S.-based monitoring centers and the largest security network in the U.S. ADT takes protecting your health seriously. Rest assured, all ADT employees are taking critical measures to help protect everyone's health, including offering contactless installation and using extra protective and sanitation tools. You can protect now, pay later with low, flexible monthly payments to fit your budget. So help protect your home today with ADT. Because he was so young and so good, and the sport isn't that popular, and at this point I'm talking about sort of triathletes, that his legend grew and his fame grew in these circles when he was a child. So unlike a sort of like a very good basketball player, football player, where you are one of thousands, if you are a 16 or 17-year-old triathlete at the time, winning and competing against adults, like you become sort of famous at a young age, which I think is part of Lance's story. And, you know, I mean, I think that you had some eyeballs on you when you were in your teens. Sort of what did it feel like to be celebrated as a teenager, and how did that affect your life?
Being young, famous, and being famous and young normally has been a curse for so many people throughout Hollywood, entertainment, artists, sports. Usually those that you see, and they're so young, they're so cute. Oh, they're going to be able to do this for so very long. Oh, they get burnt out by it in one way, shape, or form, and are unable to maintain a level of discipline and emotional stability to carry out their potential for so very long as they become adults. Because as you start to grow, your mentality and your lifestyle and your habits change. That's why you see so many artists that have young in front of their name or little in front of their name. And then as they get older, they try to change it. It's the exact same thing. You don't want to be identified as, you know, somebody that's sophomoric. And it's really tough because you're bringing so many people into your life, into people asking me about coming from a single parent home and what is it like growing up in poverty? And, oh, by the way, what is it like playing against Duke? Like, what do you think about, why are you listening to rap? What's going on with Public Enemy? Why did Ice Cube say in this interview? And then it was like, it sometimes can be overwhelming, but here's the difference between me being famous and young and Lance. I wasn't getting paid.
Good point.
I wasn't getting paid. So when you start getting money, that hopefully gives you not only stability, but it gives you, it insulates you and it protects you from a lot of things that come in your way and from multiple directions. It kind of creates a fort around you that you don't have when you're broke.
Yeah, I mean, he when he dedicated himself to cycling, some of the numbers I found astonishing. He was getting paid like $18,000 a year or something. And then that grew and grew, obviously, as he started winning Tour de France and as his spotlight grew. But, you know, he started getting paid as he was young. And when he dedicated himself to cycling, he was very successful very early. And there was an interesting sort of soliloquy that he went on about what the relationship of being on the bike meant to him and how it calms him and how it's meditative. But he also mentioned something else that he thinks about while he's on the bike. While he's on the bike, he creates little competitions, and he creates like ways, real or not, in which he was slighted or in which his competitors disrespected him and he needs to get vengeance upon them. And it really reminded me of another athlete that we've been talking about every Sunday, which is of course Michael Jordan. So how common do you think this is, where people at the highest peak of athletics create slights, create competition, create rivalries in their own head to motivate them?
It's not just in athletics. It should be in any walk of life that you're a professional, that you thrive to be in. You want to be the best. And when somebody else gets a promotion that you feel like you should have gotten, when somebody else gets an opportunity you feel like you deserve, when something happens that you feel like you work for and it doesn't fall in your favor, you're going to keep pressing. That's what you should do. That's what you hope happens. And that's what he did. And so imagine riding on a bike. Michael Jordan gets to rub elbows, grapple, dunk on people for 48 minutes. How long do they ride bikes for? A couple of hours? That's forever.
No. They ride bikes for the Tour de France is 21 days. You ride every day. Some days are longer than others, but it's usually about 6 hours. I bet say it has.
That's what I'm saying. Like, dog, he on a bike for a month. You know what I'm saying? He got to think of some stuff that's going to, you know, mentally and emotionally stimulate him. And so I'm not surprised that the great ones or the successful ones have that trait, because their ability to concentrate and take it to another level is usually what separates them from the pack.
I mean, I'm glad you brought up so how long they're on the bike, because there's also a really fascinating part of this evening's documentary where they went away from Lance for a second and they started speaking about cycling and the peloton and the sort of the flock, the amoeba of bicycles going 30, 40 miles an hour in such close quarters. And there was a really good bite where one of them, I think it was Hamilton, but I don't remember exactly who it was. Apologize. Says, it's like, you know that some people are going to crash. Like, it's just basically like Russian roulette when you're in the peloton going, you know, speeding. It's like some people are going down and you're just hoping that it's not you when you are millimeters away from another bicycle rider going 35 miles an hour. Like, hearing that and hearing him say, I've always seen it on the screen, but they sort of like took you into the peloton tonight in the thing. And I was absolutely terrified. Absolutely terrified. Cause I'm the type of person, like, if I'm going 90 miles an hour in the car, I freak out and slow down. You know what I mean? But I can only imagine going down a hill surrounded by those bodies and hearing them breathe and being millimeters away from other ones, knowing that just one little nick, one little bump can throw you off balance. And then there's, you know, another 100 riders also going 35 miles an hour, just ready to roll right over you. That I always looked at cycling as a non-contact sport. I was looking at cycling as a safe sport. I was looking at cycling as sort of like as a marathon running or something, but it's not like that at all. It is kind of a contact sport and it is kind of dangerous. And did you sort of feel the same way as you watched that section?
I did. And it's the opposite of how people feel when they're in the car. You know, sometimes it seems like people, when they have that big body around them, they feel comfortable. And then you cut them off in traffic, they'll flip you the bird or cuss you out. It just seems like people get a little more like powerful and or possessive when you're in a vehicle. But on a bike, to me, it's vulnerable, because you fall, it's going to hurt. You're getting strawberries on your knees, on your elbows, possibly hitting your head. It's close proximity. Everybody's going in the same direction. It's a reason why that sport, like you mentioned, is dangerous in its own right. And so to elevate and have the courage to ride in that sport during that climate, knowing that can happen to you, it takes a lot of practice and a lot of courage for sure.
So, we're going to transition to sort of Lance's professional career and when he starts winning things. And obviously the premier event in cycling is the Tour de France. And I say France because that's what they say. I'm not going to say Tour de France. I'm going to say France because, you know, I'm a journalist. And when he won his first, they started introducing the fact that he was doping. And what he was doing is what they call EPO, which is EPO, which is essentially, I believe, more red blood cells in your body. And it gives you sort of a 10% edge, as they said, but they really did a really good job of explaining the math of having 10% over 21 days can be the difference between winning and coming in last place. And the doping that he was doing was not necessarily being tested or tracked, but did you ever think while watching this, sort of like the same way that when we watch Olympic sprinters, there's always a kind of like, maybe, maybe not, I'm not sure. Like, when you learned about all of the success and the Tour de France wins and the times, did you sort of view the sport of cycling as one that could be tainted with scandal the way that we viewed baseball at one point and the way that we viewed other sports at one point, like track?
I didn't, because I wasn't intimately involved and I didn't understand, you know, the intricacies of what it took to be competitive, what it took to be great. What about the recovery? You're riding for so many days, all of the things you need to overcome, just the muscle memory of it. You know, they get injuries as well and that type of thing. But I have a hard line stance as somebody that was fortunate enough to basically, beside my brain, my athleticism put me in a position to do everything that I'm able to do in my life. And I'm so very fortunate. I don't respect cheaters in sports. I just want to make sure we're on the same page. So if you're taking steroids in baseball, basketball, or whatever, if you doping or you doing whatever, I don't have any respect for you, because that's a conscious decision. And once you start making that decision, you have to continue to compound it time and time again. So it's not like a mistake. To me, a mistake is you're driving, you spill coffee on your shirt, not doping, not taking steroids. So players that did it in baseball don't belong in the Hall of Fame. Lance Armstrong, for example, and all of these cyclists that talked about how they got introduced to doping and so very young, and I know that everybody was doing it type of thing. That doesn't make it any better for me.
Yeah, I mean, they painted it in the documentary as you either were doping or you were not in the competition. Like it was almost like they it wasn't an excuse, but it was just how they explained the culture of the sport was you were either doping or you weren't on the team. And that's not fair to the riders that were clean throughout their career because their careers were much shorter than those that were doping. And one thing that I want to make sure that we touch on is his bout with testicular cancer. And I think that they do a good job in this evening's documentary of explaining just that the awareness was so much lower at that time. I think that over since the 90s, you know, we're now 20, 25 years separated, that there's so much more awareness about this particular type of cancer and how prevalent it is and how to check for it. But Lance obviously let it go unchecked for quite some time and ended up being diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, which is such an important part of this narrative. And I know that next week when we get part 2, we'll sort of see the complete disastrous downside of what happens when he was truly caught with doping and it was a public thing. But you have to remember, before that happened, he, and sort of like at the end of the documentary, is kind of like at the peak of his prowess, he was not just a cancer survivor. He was a cancer survivor and absolute thriver. And before we get to the thriving, one thing I want to talk to you about, which I thought was really interesting this evening, is he was asked if he felt the doping led to testicular cancer. And he sort of calmly explained that he cannot answer yes or no to that. But he did note that the year before he had testicular cancer was the only year they ever used HGH or human growth hormone. And he went on to sort of slyly explain that if human growth hormone grows the good things, can't it also grow the bad things as well? And watching this documentary, Jalen, do you see a causality, like a true link between his use of sort of performance-enhancing drugs and his diagnosis for testicular cancer?
I believe so. And if that's not the case, that's kind of how the timeline was portrayed in the documentary. Mm-hmm. It makes you feel like, based on his doping and the things that he was putting into his body, that then led to him getting testicular cancer. And I recall that happening real time and him still being a successful rider, raising so many dollars for cancer and for awareness and things of that nature. That's why Jacoby, and you alluded to it earlier, his number with the government was so high. $100 million.
Yeah.
$100 million.
Yeah.
Like, well, I mean, he was generating.
The U.S. Postal Service was essentially saying that the entire time that he was receiving money for them and sort of like being a brand associated with them, that he was essentially a fraud. So they felt like that value was $100 million, and they actually have a pretty good case. I mean, I can understand that, but it wasn't just the U.S. Postal Service that was benefiting from his doping. It was cycling itself. And at the end of this evening's documentary, they did a good job explaining the chaos that was the scandal that was the 98 Tour de France. And then in 99, when Lance comes back, all of a sudden he's back from cancer after a very short amount of time. And look at him. He's the leader. He's not just competing. He's leading. He's got the yellow jersey on. And at one point he tested positive for cortisone. And there's a lot of people that suspected him of using performance enhancing drugs, but he tested positive for cortisone, which he clearly was using as a performance enhancing drug. But he explained it away as saying, you know what? I use that as a pain reliever for the saddle sores I was getting during racing. And the head of the cycling basically turned a blind eye to that. Do you think there was sort of an institutional blind eye turn to his performance enhancing use that was helpful for the sport, helpful for the money, helpful for the bottom line that allowed it to happen?
So this is the line of demarcation that it gets acknowledged, but I don't think it gets covered the way it should. When we see universities come to mind, that have sexual scandals with coaches and or trainers like Penn State, Michigan State, and my beloved University of Michigan.
And many more.
And many more. I believe that his taking cortisone while he knew it was something that he should not be taking. But it goes back to what I was saying. When you're flagrantly cheating David Jacoby, mm-hmm. you have to be willing, A, to hope that it puts me in position to be great. But then you also have to understand that the side effects can be deadly or painful. And that's not just physically to your body and testicular cancer and all of that stuff, but that's also emotionally, your reputation and those type of things if it gets discovered. And I just always felt like that wasn't worth it. And so as I watched this doc, to be honest, I'm like the people at the beginning of the doc. I would have been in a restaurant saying what they were saying.
Interesting. Interesting. And I think that tonight was a very good setup for what we're going to get next Sunday, which is the positive tests and the world crashing around him. And we got a little hint of it, but like the popularity of the Livestrong brand and him becoming this not just iconic athlete champion, but also a champion against cancer, like, which is one of the most devastating plagues that's ever touched the human species. And then to watch that all fall apart. I can't wait to do that next Sunday. And we will also likely be joined by the director of the film. And that's a really interesting conversation with her. I'm excited to have, because being a director of this film is very different than being the director of the Jordan film. It's much more difficult to tell this story because of all the complications that come with being Lance. And I think thus far this evening, she did an extraordinary job of sort of towing that line and telling that story as honestly as she could. We'll be back next week. Make sure that you tune in to the video and you listen to the podcast.
We're not done.
Wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're not done. We're not done.
Well, I done been all over the world.